This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, a dedicated group of homebrewing enthusiasts who take their beer, but not themselves, very seriously. You can join them at homebrewersassociation.org. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 5th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Matt Thompson, co-founder and brewer at Boston Mountain Brewing in Fayetteville, Arkansas, shares his successful strategy of jumping into home brewing with the goal of going pro in a very short period of time. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our brewing rainbow shirt. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment there, they say that new listeners will find us that way. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks very much to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. And financial supporters have already seen the episode of Basic Brewing video that I'm planning to post on Friday. That's the one where I brew my version of a pseudo sati. It was a very unusual and fun brew day that led to a tasty and unusual beer. Hey, Megan up at our sponsor Tavor is very excited about this month's set of featured breweries that you can find on Tavor. Maine Beer Company's Lunch is one of the offerings on Tavor this month. Lunch is an IPA with Amarillo, Centennial, and Simcoe with lots of fruit character and pine and herbal undertones. Sounds delicious. Along with Maine Beer Company on Tavor this month, you'll find Energy City, Grand Armory, The Brewing Project, Soquel Fermentation Project, Bow and Arrow, Zigmeister, Stable 12, and Alimentary. Maybe I pronounced some of them correctly. Tavor is a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered to you. It's not a Beer of the Month Club where somebody else chooses the beer for you. And you just, you know, it's a surprise when it shows up at your door. You only pay for the beer that you choose over the course of the month. Signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at Tavor.com. That's T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com. And download their iPhone or Android app. You'll receive notifications for two new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes from Philip at Tavor. If you're not interested in those beers, don't worry about it. Just skip those. However, when you see something you do want, and you will, just click on it and add it to your crate. The beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing you enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping. So why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase anything. In fact, if I can ask you a favor, go to Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or download the app, and when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, all one word, and you'll get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. Again, it's free to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase, so sign up at Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or with the Tavor app and enter BASICBREWING as the promo code. We appreciate the folks at Tavor for being continuing sponsors of the show. Here on the home front, I brewed another Two-Hearted Ale clone this past week. I used the second packet of Oslo that the folks at Bootleg Biology kindly sent me. I only chilled down to 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 C and fermented in a plastic bucket on my porch. The beer was done in just a couple of days. So I brought it inside and I dry hopped it with 5 ounces of Centennial for two more days. Then I kegged it. And I brewed the beer on Thursday before the holiday weekend and had finished beer on tap the following Tuesday. And it tastes darn good. I tell you, those Kvike strains are amazing. I think my go-to summer yeast from now on is going to be something like Oslo or Loki from our friends at Imperial. It's just crazy. And I love, you know, not having to cool down the wort all the way down to traditional pitching temperatures. Let's talk about our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. High Gravity has been a pioneer in the electric brewing business, and they've been building electric systems for over a decade. Their Warthog systems and controllers are awesome. You know that. Steve and I each have one. But now there are more electric options out there more than ever, and High Gravity has a bunch of them. For example, Dave says the Brewer's Edge mash and boil system with pump is a great value in the 120-volt 5-gallon space at just $399. Dave also says the new controllers from Blickman are also a great value. Both the Simple Power Controller and the Brew Commander with its touchscreen interface from Blickman can control additional power relay modules to scale up as needed for high performance at an unbeatable price. And High Gravity also has Warthog controllers that can be expanded as well with the new Power Stack module. Electric brewing takes the pain out of propane, and highgravitybrew.com is the place to go to jump in. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's at our friends, family-owned and operated, highgravitybrew.com. Okay, Steve Wilkes of stevesbrewshop.com gets people walking into his shop all the time wanting to learn how to brew and then go pro. But following through on that dream, you know, it takes a lot of work and learning along the way. Well, Matt Thompson of Boston Mountain Brewing is one who actually followed through to go from just walking into Steve's shop knowing nothing to going pro in just a short period of time. Matt Thompson, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming by.
Now, who are you and where are we?
Well, I'm Matt Thompson, like you said, and we're at Boston Mountain Brewing at 121 West Township in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
And we are dangerously close, a couple of blocks away from Steve's Brew Shop.
That's right. .com. Yep. Steve's given us a lot of help in the past when we started out home brewing. We started basically at the same time that he opened up his shop, so I give him full credit for helping us get started on this adventure that we're on now.
So give me some background. Who are you working with, and what was your background of home brewing, you know, say, before you walked into Steve's shop?
Well, let's see. I moved to Boise, Idaho in 2010, and I started back to school there at about 30 years old, working on a bachelor's degree. I got into environmental science, and then I moved back here in 2014 to Fayetteville and finished up my degree at University of Arkansas. And while I was doing that, I was working at the Walton Arts Center down on Dixon Street, and I met my partner, Sam Grinseri. And he found out that I had a scientific background, so he was big into beer. He's from San Diego. He goes out there every year and goes to 100-something breweries and tours around. He calls it market research. So that's basically where we started out. He said, "Can you make beer?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Can you figure it out?" And I said, "Sure." And so we went from there. And now we got this brewery going. So
wow. And it is an amazing place. The storefront, don't take offense, but the storefront is kind of unassuming. It's in the corner of the shopping center. But when you walk in the door, it just opens up into this expansive tasting room with the wood on the walls and this beautiful wood bar. And I was pleasantly surprised. You've really done a lot of work on this place, and it looks great.
Well, that's kind of the reaction that we were going for. When I first saw this space, it was a big open room, but I almost immediately envisioned what I've got going on here. I like the square footage. It's almost 3,000 square feet. So, like you say, it's very unassuming outside, but your reaction when you walk in, I hear a lot of wows and stuff like that. So that's always fun to hear, and we really enjoy people's reaction when they come in here.
And as I said, as I walked in, it's got that new bar smell.
Right.
So it smells like wood, which pairs well with beer. Now, I've already started. You've gotten me, I can't even count how many samples we've got. We've got nine samples?
Yeah, we have nine beers on tap right now. So you're starting out with the golden ale there, it looks like. Mm. Yeah.
Tell me about this beer.
All the beer, we get all of our grains out of a company out of West Michigan called BSG. Mm-hmm. They're a distributor. They pull in grains from all around the world, and then we order whatever we want from them. We use a lot of English malts. We use a lot of Belgian malts. Of course, a lot of two-row, both American and English. This golden ale that you're drinking right here uses a lot of two-row from the U.S. and the German Karahel is what I used in this one, which was a new grain that I hadn't really used before. And but it worked out pretty nice. I like the sweetness that it puts into the beer. So we may continue forward. I did actually order some Carapils to substitute in this in the next batch I'm doing. And I actually had an issue with my distributor, so I went over and Steve hooked me up with about 12 pounds of that to get me going on the next batch. So, yeah.
Well, there you go. There are perks.
Absolutely.
Being close to Steve. Well, it's a delicious beer. It's nice and grainy. It's very clean. It's got good fermentation character. But it is this what you would call your entry-level beer?
That's definitely the entry-level beer. I think that may even be one of the first beers that we ever brewed homebrewing. So that's kind of I tell people that's my baby. So I have done that beer probably 5, 6, 7 times in different batches and tweaked it different ways. And it's almost to where I like it. So we'll see. Maybe in another 10 tries or something like that, I'll get it where I like it.
There are homebrewers out there who have been brewing for, you know, a decade or more probably, and who've been dreaming about, you know, opening a brewery themselves. And they're hearing, you know, his flagship beer, he brewed 5 times before you. So, you know, there may be some jealousy out there that you decided to leap so quickly into the deep end. You know, being so kind of, figuratively speaking, wet behind the ears as a brewer.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, don't be jealous. I mean, this is a huge risk for me. I mean, I have a science background, so I am able to take these processes and kind of research the heck out of them. And that's where I get my base knowledge. So experience is great. And I mean, and when I say I've only been doing this for 4 or 5 years, understand that me and Sam took this really seriously when we first started. So we started brewing every Saturday. We would do a batch, and we did that consistently for 3 or 4 years. So it may not seem like we have a lot of time put into this, but we have, I mean, what does that come out to? Several hundred batches under our belt before we even started here. So
where should I go next?
I would just go on down the line. Poured those out for you in the same order they are on the board. So, yeah. The only one that I would probably do last would be this number 5, this chocolate sweet stout. That tends to deaden your taste buds quite a bit. So, yeah.
What do we got here?
That is the IPA, and I call that IPA number 2 only because that's the second try that I, second batch that I brewed up on that one.
It's tasty. It's very clean. It's got a nice bitterness background. It's also got some nice fruity character from the hops. It is crystal clear, so it's not a trendy IPA.
Oh, no. We kind of, neither one of us, me or Sam, really like the East Coast hazy IPAs that we're seeing these days. It's not that we have anything against them, but personal preference is to have clear beer for the most part. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk about this recipe.
This recipe is pretty simple. I think it's just 2-row and English caramalt, and then we use the Cascade Amarillo and Chinook hops in that one. Mm.
Yeah. And what's your hopping strategy?
A lot of bitterness at around 60 minutes, so we'll use the Cascade and the Chinook primarily for the bitterness and the Amarillo for aroma late after, like 15 minutes before the end of the boil, I should say. Yeah.
And any dry hopping or anything?
Not in that one. The Citra Pale Ale is the only one that we dry hopped, and that's coming up. I think that's number 6 here. So you got a little ways to go before you get to that one.
This is very good.
Thanks.
It's very drinkable and very clean. I'm assuming an American ale yeast.
It is. That's a 1056, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Weast out of Oregon.
And so what step me through it. I mean, what were the challenges of starting from ground zero, you know, and getting into the hobby? I mean, how did you approach it as far as what equipment or what brewing styles, or how did you get into it?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's a ridiculously complicated process for sure. I mean, I've said several times that I enjoy science. I enjoy taking things apart and understanding how they work on a fundamental level. I believe that I'm pretty good at doing that. So that helped out a lot. But as far as the process, it was just repetition. You know, we started home brewing in my mom's kitchen, actually, and we just steadily built up our equipment over time. We ended up spending, $3,000 or $4,000 on homebrew equipment by the time we were done. I mean, we just went crazy on it. We had plate chillers and all kinds of stuff strewn out across her kitchen, and nobody could use it until we were done brewing, but she enjoyed it, and we enjoyed it. And then as far as starting up the business, the hurdles were incredible. Like, it was nothing that I've ever done before in my life. The permitting, the paperwork, that was probably the biggest challenge for me personally, was just figuring out who to contact, how to get these processes complete, you know. So everything else kind of fell into place. The brew house itself was extremely challenging. I mean, it just came in. We got all of our equipment from Stout Tanks and Kettles out of Portland, Oregon. And it just came in without a whole lot of instructions on how to set it up or anything like that. There were a few rough diagrams and some stuff like, don't do this. So it was a lot of internet research. It was a lot of trial and error, and a lot of crossing your fingers and flipping that switch and hoping things don't blow up on you or something like that. You know.
What kind of system is it? How big? And is it gas or electric? Or
it's an electric system, 3-barrel system. We have 8 fermenters back there, and those are all 3 barrels. So that restricts us to 3 barrels. The hot liquor tank, I think, is a 7-barrel. The brew kettle is 6, and the mash tun is either a 3 or 4. I can't remember right now. But so all of the equipment other than the fermenters are different.
Is there anybody or anything that you would tell somebody wanting to follow your path? Anything that you would warn them against? In this whole process, is there something that was a huge stumbling block that you wish you could have done differently?
I don't think so. I think probably if I was to tell somebody, I would say don't set any deadlines. You're going to continuously be pushing your deadlines forward unless you just get really lucky. When we first started out, we rented this place in May of 2018, and we figured we would be up and running by Christmas, I think, was our first projection. And that turned into, ultimately, the end of June. So, I mean, the paperwork process and just the amount of work that you have to put into something like this just really piles up on you, and your mind tends to think that it's going to be simpler than it actually is. So that's what I would say to anybody that wants to get into this. Just be prepared to grind. It's a big grind. I mean,
yeah, I think Casey and Dorothy up at Ivoryville had that same experience of deadline creep, and you know, they thought that things would go faster than they did, and you know, a lot of it was that they, you know, did a lot of the sweat equity themselves, and right. I'm assuming that you did the same thing?
Absolutely. Me and Sam, and we had a couple other friends as well that helped out. I mean, it was definitely a team effort, big time. I couldn't have done it without any of the people that contributed to this, so yeah. But as far as doing a lot of the work ourselves, absolutely. I mean, almost everything in here is done by me and Sam or some of our friends as well. So,
What am I sipping on here?
That is the coconut porter.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very roasty. It's got that coconut sweetness in there. It's super easy drinking, though. It's nice and clean, well fermented. And I haven't been asking what ABV these are. This is, 10 o'clock on a Monday morning. there's a Subway sandwich shop a couple doors down, which I'm going to visit after this. But so talk about this beer as well.
Okay, that's a 5% beer, ABV. We use a lot of English malts in that one as well, a lot of chocolate and a lot of black malt, I think, is one of the other ones that we put in there. And we also, so after fermentation during secondary, we cold crashed that beer down to about 36 degrees, and then we added, I believe it was 20 pounds of coconut into it in a big Muslin bag or a series of Muslin bags, and allow it to just seep in the beer itself for a couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's
how'd you prepare the coconut?
The coconut, we roasted it. Yeah, we just put it in the oven and roasted it and then drop it into the fermenter.
Yeah, it's like a Mounds bar.
Oh, yeah.
It's really good.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
And we're staying dark with the next beer. What's this?
That's coffee stout. So that's kind of similar. We use a lot of English grains in a lot of our stouts. That is Onyx Coffee. That's the Monarch blend that they hooked us up with when we first started out. We called them up and we said, we asked them if they wanted to collaborate, and they were really excited about it. And so that coffee that's in there was on their recommendation, and I think that they nailed it as far as the flavor. We told them we wanted a lot of flavor and very little bitterness, and that's what they gave us.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of coffee flavor without coffee astringency, and Onyx is across the street basically as well. So there's tons of ways on how to get coffee into your beer, and a lot of them, work very well. How did you do this one?
This one is also, we cold crashed the beer and added into there. So the reason that I did that is I researched and found out that when you hot brew coffee, it releases the tannins, and that's where you get a lot of the bitterness. So it just made sense to cold brew it in there. So
are these whole beans?
Those are whole beans, but we crushed them through our mill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you just put the coffee in the fermenter, or did you use some sort of a bag, or how did?
We use a Muslin bag similar to what we use with the coconut. So.
You would think that that if you didn't, there'd be some gumming up of the works.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I say that I used a Muslin bag for the coconut, and we did on the second batch, but on the first batch, we just dumped it in there. And boy, when I popped open that fermenter after we were done kegging, I'm not exaggerating when I say it was almost halfway full with swollen coconut flakes. So, yeah. So we decided to modify that process for the next batch.
So that's a lesson learned.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of those. Absolutely. I mean, like you say, we haven't been doing this a long time, so we make a lot of rookie mistakes and stuff. But so far, the beer is turning out well, so we're pretty happy.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I'm about halfway through the flight here, and I'm impressed. It's very good. My wife likes dark beers, and so she would especially enjoy the coconut beer and the coffee beer. The thing is tricky with coffee beers is that, I want to drink them, but most of the time I'm not drinking beer at 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm kind of caffeine sensitive, so, I usually don't enjoy coffee beers in the evening, so it's nice to have one, when I don't have to worry about staying up all night.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that thing's got a kick to it, too. I haven't been able to calculate accurately how much coffee, or caffeine, I should say, is in it, but it's probably a pretty good punch. It'll probably wake you up.
So you'll be... what's the ABV on this?
That one is 4.7.
Oh, well, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of our stouts are pretty low, below 5%, or right at about 5%.
Well, that's good. So... So talk about Steve's tutoring style. I mean, you know, how is he working with new homebrewers working in, or walking into his shop?
Oh, Steve's great, man. I mean, he answered all the questions I ever threw at him. He helped us put together grain builds when we were first starting out. I mean, if you are a new home brewer, and I recommend this to a lot of people that come in here, if you're looking to get into it and you need equipment or you need advice, anything like that, Steve's a pro, man, and he's very helpful. So definitely go down there and talk to him.
Yeah, he's a good mentor. And he's got a lot of patience because, you know, new brewers or people who are thinking about brewing probably have the same questions over and over and over again. And, you know, he's probably got rote answers, but... You know, he's patient, and he knows that the process is intimidating, you know, and he leads him through.
Absolutely. I mean, if he does have rote answers, you can't tell. I mean, he's just totally natural at it and very helpful and very, very nice guy. I mean.
I was about to drink the one I wasn't supposed to drink yet. So
the coffee. That's right.
We'll skip we'll skip that one. So what's this
that one? That is going to be the Citra Pale Ale. So that's made with a lot of Citra hops, a lot of American malts. We brewed it to be kind of sweet on the back end as well. Get some grapefruit flavor in there.
Mm. That's nice, but it's got a good bittering level as well.
Right.
So talk about the malt bill, talk about the hops.
That one... is American and United Kingdom malts, and it's hopped with Citra and for bitterness and for flavor, and then Amarillo as well for some flavor on the back end.
Hmm. So you said there was dry hopping on this too?
That one is dry hopped as well. Yeah, we dry hopped that with Citra hops for, I want to say it was about 2 or 3 weeks, something like that. I think it was 2 weeks. Wow. I don't like to leave it in too long. You get some weird flavors that come off the hops if you're not careful. Yeah.
That's very nice. It's very fruity. If I were to close my eyes, I might think it would lean toward a New England IPA. You know, it's got a lot of fruit. And, you know, right. New England IPAs do have a lot of fruit character, you know, because of the way they're hopped. But this one is crystal clear, so I think this may be one that's, you know, straddling that line.
Yeah, I would probably say that's true. I mean, a lot of the motivation, it seems like, for those East Coast hazy IPAs is kind of to, I think people describe them as juicy is one of the things mm-hmm. that people say a lot, and I think you're probably dead on with how that the flavor profile of that is. But Sam, being from the East Coast, that was his idea. He went out there and he visited, who was it that made the Sculpin IPA out there? I'm drawing a blank now. But he visited a real prominent brewery out there that used a lot of Citra hops and came back just raving about how good they were. So that's where that beer came from.
So what, as a new brewery owner, what do you do to get the word out? I mean, what do you do to do marketing? I mean, you know, what it seems like to me that would be a challenge is to... you know, Northwest Arkansas is a growing area, and the craft beer scene is growing as well. So, you know, there are a lot of places to go to get beers. How do you fit in? How do you get attention?
Honestly, you'd be amazed at the lack of marketing that is needed, and I'm not saying that to brag or anything like that, but we basically just posted on Facebook. The Fayetteville Flyer picked us up a couple times and did a couple articles, and that was amazing. Those guys really put a good word out for us, and a lot of the people that come in say that that's where they first heard about us, so that helped out a lot, and the Facebook helps out a lot. But really and truly, the craft beer following in Northwest Arkansas is just so amazing that the word of mouth, once one person finds it, I mean, it just blew up on us. We didn't expect to be doing as well as we did in our first month, so we're really grateful to the craft beer followers. They just really made it good for us.
Well, you're putting out a good product, though. I mean, if you're putting out a bad product, the word would spread twice as fast, probably.
Well, that's probably true as well. Yeah, I mean, I'm blown away by the reception that the beers had. I mean, I knew it was good beer, but people are just really loving it. So I'm just going to – there's a lot of pressure to keep it good, so that's what I'm going to focus on.
So what do we got here?
That one, let's see, what is that? That would be the double IPA.
talk about this beer while I sip.
Okay, the double IPA we just used, I think it was only Citra hops, if I remember. No, we used Citra and Chinook hops, so we probably bittered with the Chinook hops, if I'm remembering correctly, and then flavored with the Citra for aroma. We doubled the grain bill, so that one is basically based off of the IPA too, as far as the grain bill goes. So we doubled that, and then we just added, I want to say, 10 pounds of hops into that one.
Yeah, well, it's well balanced. One of the dangers that you get into when you double up a grain bill is to have a higher finishing gravity, mm-hmm. have that higher residual sweetness,
right.
Which this probably does. I don't know if you remember how this beer finished.
It still finished out, I think, about 10:30 or something like that, and it started out right around probably 10:80 or 90, if I remember correctly, so it didn't finish out dry or anything like that, but I agree, I think the balance turned out really well. I'm really happy with the way it did.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed it was that high of a finishing gravity. It's nice and clean. Drinking game for this episode is every time I say clean, but
right. Yeah.
But it's nice and clean. There is residual sweetness, but I wouldn't say that it's overly sweet because it's balanced. You loaded in a ton of hops in there to counteract that. So it is for a double IPA, it is extremely approachable, I would say, because you know a lot of times with a double IPA, at least according to my palate, brewers might tend to overcorrect and overbitter, and then you get what my wife calls the vomit beer effect. You know, where you taste a beer and at the end of it, it's like that astringency or that acidity that you get after
absolutely
after you take a spit, as they say on Letterkenny. But this is very nice. It's very dangerously approachable, and you probably serve this in smaller serving sizes than the rest of the beers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Those come in 12-ounce. They're like tulip glasses or something like that. And then, it's an 8.8% beer, so it definitely is dangerous if you're not careful. I agree with you as far as the overhopping, and that's one of my pet peeves. You know, I'm honestly, and this might turn some people away, but I'm not a huge IPA fan for that reason. I think a lot of times it's way too bitter, and they don't focus on the flavor of the hop itself. So that's kind of my mission moving forward is, you know, appease the bitterness or the people who like the bitterness as much as possible, but focus on the flavor of the hops and the unique quality of the hops. So that's what I like to do.
Yeah, well, I think you've accomplished it.
Thanks.
So, from a lab perspective, from a scientist's perspective, you've got whenever you pitch a big beer like this, high in gravity, you've got to take care of the yeast. So what do you do to ensure that a fermentation like this, as challenging as this, comes out as well as these others?
Well, you start with what the strain of yeast that you want. This is a West Coast IPA yeast, so it's coming out of wheast again, or Y yeast, however you say it, and it's cultured to sustain itself throughout high alcohol beers. So that's one thing that you definitely want to look at when you're just choosing the strain of yeast, is if it will handle the high alcoholic beers, because obviously the alcohol is bad for the yeast itself. And then you want to oxygenate your wort real well, and you want to do a yeast starter, and you want to pitch a little bit more yeast into a high alcohol beer, at least in my experience, it seems to help out a lot. So that's what I do.
Do you use any simple sugars or table sugars or anything like this in this beer?
No. I try not to add any extra sugars into the beer. I know that that's kind of a method that a lot of people use, but I haven't really experimented with it yet, and I don't plan to if I can get away with it. I've been looking into, and I can't remember what you call it, exactly, but basically where you will mash a batch, put it into, say, your boil kettle, and then mash a second batch with new grain, and then add it, and use the wort that you made previously to create a very high alcohol beer. So I think I might do that moving forward if I want to get like a 9 or 10% beer, but I don't plan on adding sugars if I can help it.
So I think that thanks to Chris Colby, I think that's reiterated mashing. I think we did a show on that many years ago. But yeah, using wort as the brew, as the mash water to go, and then, but that presents more challenges in itself, because you've still got to louder all those sugars out. You know, you've got to rinse all those sugars out of the mash.
Right.
So. You know, it may have some advantages in some areas and some disadvantages in others.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it all starts in the mash. As far as, you know, how fermentable your beer is going to be, you have to keep those temperature profiles right where you want them to be. So, yeah, I mean, there's challenges. Challenges to brewing a high alcohol beer are pretty significant, really, especially with my equipment, you know, dumping in 300 pounds of grain into, I think it's a 3-barrel mash tun, it fills up pretty quick. So you can't really get a nice thin mash out of what I've got. So I've got to kind of get creative and figure out ways to do that.
And I'm assuming your fermentation is temperature controlled.
Oh, yeah. It's all Brewmation is the company that put together all of my automation. So, yeah, it's all temperature controlled. I have sensors and all the fermenters and on all the brewing equipment as well. And it's a pretty nice system.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's one area where you might get some fusely off flavors, especially with a higher alcohol beer, as the, you know, the yeast goes a little crazy and gets a little too hot and starts throwing off unhappiness.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a risk. We got a glycol chiller back there, and it's probably more than we need, really, or that's what I've been told anyway. So it really handles the temperature as well. So we haven't had any problems. To me, brewing beer is all about temperature, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, people probably argue that with me. Like, I mean, brewing beer, everybody wants to say this is the best way to do it and this is the worst way to do it and all that kind of stuff. But for me, anyway, personally, temperature is number one on my list. Mm. Yeah.
So we've got another roasty beer here, another dark beer.
Yep, that's the Robust Porter, and it's based off of the Coconut Porter, but we don't put any, like in the Coconut Porter, we have lactose added, we have coconut added, we have some candy sugar added. So I guess when you asked me if we add sugar, we did add candy sugar into the coconut. I'd forgotten about that. But this is just a nice dark porter that we brewed to basically... give you a taste of what the grain profiles in a build like that would be.
It's very nice, very roasty. So what grains do we have here?
That's the same almost exactly as the coconut porter, so you're going to have a lot of English grains, you're going to have a lot of chocolate and I think coffee malts into that one, and then a base build, I believe, of Maris Otter is what we have in there. Yeah, I like Maris Otter. That gives you a nice bready malty flavor in your beer. So,
and what was the yeast on that one?
That one is a 1056 as well. I use a lot of different strains. I don't want to sound like I'm using only 1056, but I do use 1056 a lot. It's a nice versatile yeast. I would recommend it almost for any beer unless you're looking for a specific off flavor or something like that. Mm-hmm. yeah
it's very nice though. I mean, the grains themselves give it a lot of that English character that may or may not be accentuated by using an English yeast, you know, to give you more kind of fruity esters. But it's nicely balanced and well drinkable, and you know, there's enough hops in there to keep it interesting and to keep it balanced. It's not too sweet. So very good. This one is a reddish, it has a reddish hue to it.
Yeah, that's the Huel Melon Pale Ale. So that's a new hop that I discovered. And I say new hop, I don't know exactly how long it's been around, but I'd never heard of it before. It's out of Germany. And it gives, a lot of people describe it as like a honeydew or a cantaloupe flavor in there. So it's a pretty popular beer, actually. People seem to like new flavors and new hops and stuff like that. So I think I'm going to focus on that a little bit on moving forward on my beers, is just trying to discover these hops that maybe aren't so mainstream and see if I can brew up some good beers with that. The reddish color, it is pretty red, and I'm not exactly sure what I did to that beer to make it that color. I guess it could be a quality of the hop itself, because I didn't really use any crazy grain in it that I didn't use and haven't used in any other beers anyway, so...
Yeah, it's kind of a deep copper color. the flavor of the hops is nice and fruity. Talk about your hopping strategy with this one.
That one, I think we used only Huel Melon in that one. No, I'm sorry. We used Chinook to bitter, and then we used Huel Melon later on at the 30-minute, 15-minute, and then I whirlpool with a lot of my hops. So that seems to add a lot of flavor into the beer.
Yeah. And with different systems, whirlpooling for like a 20-barrel system would mean something different to you with your 3-barrel system. So how long is a whirlpool? I mean, if a home brewer with a 5-gallon system were to want to come in and kind of duplicate this recipe, we've done some experimentation with hop stands at different temperature, after the boil, adding hops at different temperatures and maintaining that temperature for 30 minutes or whatever.
Okay.
So do you have an indication of how long and at what temperature your whirlpool is that when you add these hops, or is it just kind of, am I making, I've had 8 beers. Am I making sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely. You're making sense. And I would say that my method anyway, I have a little transfer pump. I think it's a 1.5 horsepower, something like that. And I can hook it up, to the drain and to the tangential outlet, and then I will just pump it until it achieves velocity, and that's about it. I'll shut it off, and once it's achieved maximum velocity, I'll shut it off, and then I'll just let it sit until I can see no more movement in there, and then I'll do a transfer. Mm-hmm. And for, like you say, it's going to be different if you're doing a 5-gallon batch compared to me. I mean, by the time I'm done with boiling, doing the whirlpool, I've got about 110 gallons in the boil kettle, so it's going to take long time to transfer it into the fermenter. It takes probably an hour to get it into the fermenter once I've run it through the plate chiller and all that kind of stuff. So even at, when I say I whirlpool it, you're really doing it the entire time you're transferring it. So, I'm talking maybe an hour and a half once you've achieved velocity, allowed it to settle, and then done the transfer.
And that's an area where I think, as home brewers using immersion chillers, we've kind of shortchanged ourselves in the past, because even if you add hops at flame out and then you go ahead and you start chilling, well, you can knock down, especially even in summertime here where the tap water is hot, you can knock down to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what, 37.8? Centigrade. But you can knock that initial heat off in a very short period of time, 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And so you're not achieving that, it's not even isomerization, but utilization of those hops during that time. So for hoppy beers where you want to get a lot of the fruitiness out of the hops, like in this beer, we may want to be a little more patient, as home brewers and letting the hops stand at higher temperature for a little longer period of time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line, and it just depends on what kind of product you're trying to get out of it, but I would agree with that. I mean, I think, and this is going to be another source of contention potentially, but a lot of people are concerned that they're going to infect their beer or something like that, so they'll want to chill it and get it into a sealed container as quickly as possible. But I mean, if you really get deep into it, the chance of infection is pretty low unless you really do something wrong, stick your hand in there or something like that. I mean, because you're going to be fermenting the beer pretty soon after you do a transfer, so the yeast are going to take care of a lot of that kind of stuff. So I don't really concern myself with it a whole lot, and I haven't had an infection yet. So.
Well, and you've got a clean brew house, I'm assuming. If the front of the house, I haven't been back there yet, but if the back of the house is anything like the front of the house, it's immaculate. So as I move on to this last beer, it may be too early to talk about this, but do you have a long-range plan for the future? I mean, at what scale are you shooting for, or are you already there?
I think for the most part, we're already there. Sam and I have discussed distribution, so it's possible that if this place really starts doing well and we can invest in a second location, we may create basically a distribution center where we can bottle and can and get it out into stores or whatever. But that's probably a couple years in the future, and we're not really concerned about that right now. We enjoy having a nice tap room that people like to come into. We're focusing on making the best beer that we possibly can, and that's really where we're at right now and probably where we'll stay for the most part.
I've compared the brewing industry to the restaurant industry.
Right.
You know, you've got mom and pop organizations. You know, they have one restaurant. They have a dedicated neighborhood following or whatever. They keep the booths and tables filled, and they're happy with that. And then you have, you know, citywide chains, which have two or three locations. Then you have regional chains, and then you have national and international. You know, but as long as people are achieving their goals at each of those levels, there's no shame in being at those levels. You know what I'm saying? If you're happy and successful in running a food truck,
absolutely,
then you should be happy with being at the food truck level.
I agree 100%. I think, I'm not saying that I may not open up new locations. I have friends and stuff that are already pushing for me to do stuff like over in Eureka Springs or down in Conway, things like that. But I got to tell you, this was an exhausting experience, and I think that I need some time to like de-stress and kind of reevaluate exactly what I want to do going forward. So,
and you don't want to get ahead of yourself. I mean,
yeah.
You know, there are breweries who try to expand too quickly and discover that, you know, they're like the coyote. They run out there and, you know, past the cliff, and there's nothing under them. You know, and you need to make sure that you have your solid base to move on, said the guy who's never, you know, done anything, you know, to run a small business except for this wacky little thing. So, but it seems to me that, you know, you find your niche and you grow it and you exploit it, and then you decide whether you want to move on.
Absolutely. I mean, all experience is valid, and I want to make sure that this isn't just a fluke or something like that. You know, I mean, I have to keep my ego in check a lot of times because I have a lot of people coming in here saying, you have great beer. What are you doing with your beer? And I mean, this is like, I've never come to a place where I liked all the beer. And so I got to be really careful because I have a tendency to let my head blow up, you know? So I got to keep that in check and make sure that I'm actually creating this beer in a method that I can replicate or continue to build upon. Mm-hmm. You know, so that it stays good and people keep liking it. So.
Yeah, you gotta brew your flagship recipe, you know, 8-9 times maybe before you.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, yeah, it's crazy. I don't understand it really. I mean, I tell people, and this is it's a total joke. I mean, I didn't really do this, but I feel like I pulled off some kind of scam or something like that sometimes, you know, because I don't have a lot of experience. I recognize that, you know, but the product speaks for itself, I guess, you know. So as long as people keep liking it, I'll keep making it.
And I've got the last beer. What have I got?
That's the chocolate sweet stout. Mm. So I totally nerd out on a lot of different aspects on beer. I'll spend a couple days or weeks even researching where beers came from, you know, specific styles, like how the porters started before the stouts and then became stouts, and that they were really popular over in England, and they made them with these types of grains and with this types of yeast, and they have all these different aspects. So that one I modeled after a traditional English sweet stout, which a lot of people say in the U.S. anyway, English milk stout. So it is a milk stout. It's got lactose in it, all that kind of stuff. But I also added in Mexican vanilla and Ecuadorian cacao nibs.
Oh, nice.
Into after I had cold crashed it. So a lot of the beer I cold crash, it's almost like I lager a lot of almost all the beer that I make. And that seems to be, like I hear you say, terms like clean and smooth and stuff like that, and I think that's probably where that comes from. So
yeah, it's again very nice. It is sweet, you know, like milk chocolate, but then there is in the back of the tongue, there is a bitter chocolate aspect to it that may be from the nibs that balances it out. So it's not like too sweet. There's in the beginning it's a milk chocolate, and at the end of the drink it's a darker, more bitter chocolate. So it's very multi-dimensional.
Yeah, I tried to balance it with the grains that I use and still allow those to come forward a little bit, and with the ingredients. The ingredients are, of course, very overpowering. They kind of take over the beer. So, I enjoy it. It's kind of one of those beers that people either hate or like. Like, I got people that'll come in here and they will sit down and they'll drink, no kidding, 5 or 6 of those things.
Wow.
Or they'll come and get a growler before they go out of town or something like that. And then there's other people that are just don't like it, it's too sweet or something like that, but you know, like, to each their own.
Well, very nice. It's not what I would call a novelty beer, you know. It's very drinkable. I don't know if I would want a full growler of it, but you know, but a pint would be fine, especially you know, maybe with some you know, pulled pork or something like that.
Sure. Yeah,
good barbecue beer. Yeah. Well, Matt, this has been fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very nice.
Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, congratulations, and best of luck with the continuing venture.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks again to Matt. He gave me a tour of the brewing setup after our conversation, and it's impressive. They've definitely done the work to set themselves up to get a good start, and be looking forward to tasting more of the stuff from Boston Mountain Brewing. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.